The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And thrilled, I think geographically, this might be the furthest interview I have done live from Tasmania. Johnny Hughes, the winemaker for Mewstone Vineyard in Tasmania. Johnny, thank you so much for doing the podcast today.
Great to be with you, Matthew.
Let's just start at the beginning. Actually, before your journey, for people who don't know, when they think about Australian wine and the stereotypes of, you know, just big, full-bodied, full-throttle Syrah or Cabernet or things like that, maybe some people know what's going on in Hunter Valley or Margaret River. Tasmania is really different. I was wondering if you could just sort of explain to people the wines and just sort of general overview of what wines from Tasmania is all about.
I guess you could sum Tasmania up as a genuine cool climate region, as we would like to refer to it, which does separate it from large parts of mainland Australia, which are much warmer in their nature. So Tasmania, I guess, has built a reputation based largely on sparkling and Pinot Noir. So traditional method sparklings have long been a mainstay of the Tasmanian wine industry. Not surprisingly, with that climate, where we have those slightly higher acid, slower ripening, later seasons, Pinot Noir, and then I guess things like Chardonnay and Riesling are also incredibly well suited to Tasmania. So it's a fairly young industry, I guess, in the sense that it really sort of had its first coming in the 1980s. There's a few small little bits and pieces. I think the oldest vineyard in Australia may have even been planted in Tasmania way back when. But
really?
Yeah, there was a tiny little one planted in what is now basically Newtown. So yeah, it's certainly got a rich history, but that history was very short-lived in the 1800s and then really came back into vogue in the 1980s. And we saw significant plantings really starting in the 1980s. Then I guess we had the next wave came in around the 2000 mark. So as an industry, we started a bit differently to many areas where we probably had a handful of really good winemakers in those early years making for a lot of smaller vineyards. But I think that led to a really high level of quality because we just had some people that were very well trained and very thoughtful winemakers getting to work with fruit. And so the average wine coming out of Tasmania was always really pretty good. It didn't go through some of those teething problems, let's say, that some industries do when they're new because everyone's sort of just doing it in their shed and some of them are great and some of them are a bit average. And then in the last 20 years, it's been an incredibly high growth sort of industry for Tasmania, which is, I guess, one of the more southern wine growing regions in the world.
I mean, even though I got my WSET diploma many years ago, Tasmania was just being touched on and we certainly studied it a little bit. First time I really tried it was at a restaurant, just some Tasmanian Pinot, and absolutely loved it. So now I keep my eye open, the giant wine stores in Ontario called the LCBO. And listening to you describe sort of the climate and stuff, it kind of reminds me a little bit of Niagara, where in the Niagara region here, it's cool climate, but warm enough, especially in the fall for a long enough ripening season. And we specialize in Pinot and Chardonnay. So I'm sure the soils are different, but it sounds like there is some similarities between what goes on in Niagara and what goes on in Tasmania.
Yeah, and I think even I worked in the Okanagan back in the day, and I can still see some crossover with that as well. They maybe got slightly warmer summer periods. But certainly, yeah, there's been a bit going on in Canada. And since I worked in Canada, I've noticed a lot more Pinot and Chardonnay coming out of Canada, and it's really not surprising. It's that genuine cool climate. I guess a lot of Canadians would be more familiar with some of the South Island, New Zealand sort of wines. And again, that felt like home for me when I studied in New Zealand. So yeah, if you compare it internationally to some of those regions, that's where I think you're pegging it, rather than against typical mainland Australian wines that have dominated the sort of export scene for Australia for many years.
Well, let's talk a little bit about you, and we'll eventually get to you and your brother starting Mewstone Vineyard. How do you go from studying economics to making Pinot Noir?
So it's a fairly long journey. No, it wasn't actually that long a journey. It was realizing that I did not want to sit in an office for the rest of my life. I had a graduate job, and I put on a fair bit of weight and got a little bit depressed, I think. Realised that I needed to have a change, and I went on a little bushwalk, as we call them here, a trek with my dad up on the east coast of Tasmania. And his advice during that walk was, why don't you just pick an industry that you think you'd be interested in and then find out what job you want within the industry, rather than trying to figure out when you're a 20, 21-year-old exactly what job you want to do for the rest of your life. And so I picked the wine industry, which had become, I wasn't fanatical or anything like that. It just become a real interest where I'd love to open a bottle of wine with a friend on a Friday night to get out of our formal dinners at uni. So I just picked the wine industry thinking it could be marketing, it could be running the business side of it, it could be the vineyard work, it could be the winery work, it could be the sales work. It was one of those very open-ended, sounds like a nice industry. And at the time in Tasmania, we're talking the early 2000s, it was a time where it seemed like an industry that had a bright future in Tasmania to me. Yeah, it really seemed like an industry that was going to grow in Tasmania. So it seemed like there would be opportunities down the track.
Yours is an interesting one. It wasn't, you didn't come from a family of winemakers. You weren't traveling in Europe and had an old bottle of Chambu Moussigny. This was really more about you finding joy in life and trying to find purpose versus I'm obsessed with wine, I need to make it my life. It was more about you trying to find joy in your life.
Yeah, I think it was about opening up I guess the history of that comment from my dad came from, he ended up in the dairy industry, but he was an accountant. So he ended up running, he was the 2IC at one of the largest sort of dairy companies in Tasmania by the time he finished up. And he truly enjoyed the industry of dairy, and he understood it and he knew the ins and outs. But that wasn't his history in any way, shape or form. He was an accountant to the end. And so that's where his advice came from, which is he took joy out of his job partly because it involved the greater industry. And so that was the track. And then it turned out it was pretty easy. Then for me, it was studying in New Zealand because it was cheaper to study in New Zealand than Australia. Wasn't it? As it turns out, that was a really, I guess, consequential decision though, because when studying in New Zealand, as I touched on earlier, we were looking at the types of grapes and wine that suit Tasmania too. So it made a lot more sense in many ways to study at a New Zealand institution where we were going to be looking at sparkling and Sauvignon and Pinot rather than looking at Barossa Shiraz and Hunter.
Right.
So the Australian institutions, I guess, have their roots deep in much warmer growing regions, whereas New Zealand has its roots in cool climate viticulture. So for me, that actually made a lot of sense, and it gave me the opportunity, which was one of the reasons I wanted to do the wine industry, was the opportunity to travel, because that was implicit in, if you want to do wine, you are going to travel. You are going to go and see other regions of the world. You're going to try and work in other regions of the world. And so for me, that journey started straight away by throwing a backpack on and going over to live in New Zealand for a year. So it was great.
I want to get to Cherry Orchards and your brother in 2011, but you mentioned travel. What are some of your memories? Because you worked at, just doing the research, Felton Road versus Hunter Valley versus you're in Piemonte. And then, as you mentioned, Okanagan. Those are very, very different terroirs and different regions of the world.
Yeah, I guess a lot of that came through naivety. I just sort of would pick a spot where I thought, one, I could work with visas and other aspects, and two, that sounded like I really wanted to go there. So for me, yeah, that started with going back to New Zealand to do a summer season at Felton Road. So that was in the vineyards at Felton Road, with the intention probably of staying to do vintage. But that was a year they got massive frosts throughout the region, and so there basically wasn't any cellar hand jobs going. So I ended up back in the Mornington Peninsula that year, which I guess was my first vintage making Pinot, because I'd worked in South Australia the year before. So that was my first sort of Pinot vintage, if you like, Pinot Chardonnay down in Mornington. And then I sent out about 100 emails to Italy, because I decided I wanted to work in Italy somewhere.
Smart.
I was very open. I was really open. I said, I don't speak Italian. I wrote my application in English, and I wrote about 100 emails, and I got literally about 3 offers, one of which was actually going to pay me, and the other two were just going to put me up. And that was with the Trettos. I didn't realise at the time, I was completely, completely naive to the fact that Barolo was one of the great wine regions of the world. I had no idea that I would be one of maybe two people in the whole region working that vintage whose dad wasn't an exporter, importer. It was an incredibly hard place to get work at the time. Like they really didn't have international cellar hands coming in for vintage. It wasn't a really big thing, unless you had a connection, because so many people, I realize now, were desperate to work there. Most people put their hand up for free. That wasn't me. I needed money. I was poor. So I got incredibly lucky. Alessandro gave me a job. And looking back, I'd say that's probably the most formative of all the vintages I did in terms of just the way I think about wine. I think that was really, that was, yeah, there was huge outtakes from that vintage, which carried right through the rest of my career. So, and a beautiful part of the world. So I still look back at that as one of my favorite, all-time favorite vintages. It was just, we happened to get a cracker of a year too. It was 2004, which was one of the great vintages. So that always makes life a bit better because everyone's in a good mood. So yeah, and then Canada became the Okanagan. It's easier for an Australian to work in Canada than the US. So if I'm doing Northern Hemisphere, and I was thinking I might do an English speaking one, because as great as Italy was, there was, the 3.5 months there when you've only got a handful of people you can talk to gets a bit challenging. I decided on Canada over the US mainly because it was a lot easier to work in Canada than the US, as an Australian citizen. So, and I landed in the Okanagan with Sumac Ridge. And that's probably the flip of a vintage, though. We had a really small vintage. And so life was pretty calm, and it was a bit of a, dare I say, a boring vintage, because there just wasn't much volume of fruit. So they were all staffed up for a proper vintage, and suddenly the yields came in light. So it certainly showed me that some vintages can be a bit lean. But it was a great time, and I really enjoyed that part of the world. Spent a week or two in Vancouver on the way out, because literally vintage finished 2 or 3 weeks earlier than expected. And yeah, and apart from that, yeah, shipping around Australia as well was always a really important facet of what we did.
I love, by the way, I love the idea of you going to Italy and then getting there and realizing how important Barolo is. And also, that must have been a little bit intimidating. You were younger, still starting your wine journey, and now you're in one of the, and I've been there twice, you're in one of the most iconic wine regions of the world.
Yeah, and it almost barely dawned on me at the time. It honestly didn't. Again, maybe the if I look back now, it's the joy of youth, isn't it? You just blunder in and away you go. And I quickly realised I was working for as well for one of the really kind of fairly iconic, one of the sort of, I think Trento has a really strong place in the transition of Barolo from the old to the new. So it was a really interesting space to work in that sense, that they were steeped in tradition, but they'd also progressed the way they did things really, and really been one of the wineries that helped put Barolo on the map, in the sense that they were very outward looking. They looked to the US, they looked to export, they looked to the new way of making wine. So yeah, absolutely. I think some of the best decisions you make are the ones that you don't think too hard about. It feels like a good idea, so you just do it. And so often those decisions turn out to be good ones.
Speaking of decisions, let's go to around 2011, or I guess probably a little bit before then. What made you and your brother finding an old cherry orchard? What was it about that piece of land outside of Hobart that you thought, okay, this is where we could source and really make some good wine?
It was one of those things, I guess. Matt was working in finance up in Sydney, and really enjoyed wine. So, we'd often have a chat about it. And one of his very good friends, who's still one of his very best friends, told him about a little vineyard called Demure, just which happens to be about 300 metres from our current vineyard. And he said, the next time you're in Hobart, see if Johnny knows Dirk and can take you for a visit, because I think his Pinots are really outstanding. So I did, and we went down, and this is in sort of mid-2010. Early 2010. Matt came down for the weekend. We visited Dirk, tried his Pinots around 05, 06 vintages. He did a couple of really fantastic Pinots. Matt noticed a block of land 300 metres down the road for sale, which is now Mewstone. So it was an incredibly fortuitous thing that happened. It was sort of accidental. And I think Matt flew back down 2 weeks later, a week later, 2 weeks later. Said we and lined up a visit. We walked onto the property, and Matt said, "Do you think we can grow grapes here?" And I just took one look and I said, "This is just a cracker of a site." By this stage, the cherries had been cleared for a few years, so it was a grassy paddock with bales of hay in it. And I just looked at the site, and I really did like Dirk's Pinots. And I looked at our site and said, well, if Dirk just over there, who has a slightly lower aspect, has slightly closer to the bush, has a bit less sunshine, can do that, then I feel like this site's like the next level of that, because it's just that little bit more open, that little bit, the aspect was a little bit better, the slopes were a little bit steeper. It was just a really fortuitous moment where I just went, yes, I think that's a great idea, Matt. You should buy it, and we should plant grapes. And I think Matt bought it that week. By that summer, we were planting grapes. So not a lot of thought, not a lot of planning, just again, a fairly gut feel kind of decision where it just was, we didn't do any soil tests, we didn't do any of the things that you should do.
I
purely on instinct.
love it. Hey, listen, it's worked out. It's worked out for you. What are your memories of your first vintage? What are your memories of the early years of Mewstone?
I guess in 2015, so the first official vintage with a label on it is 2016, but in 2015, we netted the very small amount of grapes we had. We were hoping for more. Turns out we would always be hoping for more 10 years later. But we literally only had, it was 250 kilos, a little less, 200 kilos. I'd even bought a barrel to ferment because we thought we were going to get, half a ton or a ton of grapes. Instead, we had 200 and, yeah, two. 200, 220 kilos. So we put that into a new barrel. I pulled the head out of a new barrel, and I had Matt hand picking out bunches to do a partial whole bunch. His first experience in the wine industry. We ended up with a little half barrel of Pinot that we bottled. There's some great photos of Mum. I lifted her up on a forklift so she could hold the hose in so we could gravity fill the bottler. Yep, it was a very family affair. And we bottled off this little sort of 100, 110 litres of Pinot without adding any sulphur, just as a pure trial batch. We'll just drink this as a family. And then the next year it was Mum's, I think it must have been her 70th birthday. I'll make her too old. She'll get upset with me. I think it was her 70th birthday the next year. So we all went out for a big family dinner that everyone flew back down to Hobart for it. And we opened a bottle of the Pinot, and it was actually quite good. And I think that let everyone sigh in relief and think, oh yeah, this is a site that has a lot of potential. That first 2015 vintage gave us a lot of confidence that we'd made a good decision, because structurally and intensity-wise, the wine just already had it. It was, and we look back at that wine, which, like I said, we bottled with like 10 parts sulfur at bottling, so basically nothing. Incredibly, over the last couple of years, we've been opening a few of those bottles, and you could argue they're amongst the best wine that's come off the site so far.
Those bottles must mean so much to you, because not only it's the first proof of concept and your first real victory, but also just such a, as you said, such a family affair as well.
Oh yeah, that was it. It can't be understated how rewarding those moments are. I think the idea that you planted it, you had friends helping you. I spent all my weekends down there. For those first few years, that was, it was very much a side project. I had a proper job. Matt was living in Sydney. It was a weekend job, so it was a lot of hard graft in those early years. But just to do it yourself from concept right through, I think, yeah, it does certainly add a whole layer of reward in to get something in a bottle. And then 2016, probably even more so when you get that first one in a bottle that's labelled and goes to market and gets shared with the greater world. Yeah, it's a really rewarding experience.
Do you remember the first time you were out at a restaurant or so, or at a wine store, and you saw your wine and you didn't even know it, and suddenly, like, or someone's ordering a bottle of your wine? Have you? It feels like something out of a movie. Have you had any moments like that?
There's been many along the way, and I don't sometimes know how to take it. I remember sitting for a lunch with the distributor at a little restaurant in Flinders Lane, a really good little restaurant in Flinders Lane in Melbourne. And we were stopping for the middle of trade day having lunch. And suddenly I noticed there was three tables around us. It was only a half full restaurant. And three tables had a bottle of our Hughes & Hughes Riesling. And it was the only thing being drunk in the restaurant. And I just felt, at that moment, I was just like, oh, please don't tell them that I was here. And sure enough, then he goes, oh, that's your wine.
Did you feel like a celebrity?
You have a moment where you certainly feel, people, oh, I love this one, and it's a great feeling. Let's be honest, humans, we love positive feedback,
Of course.
and in those early years, we had We had a bunch of, we got really lucky with some reviews and some awards and things in those first couple of years that absolutely, I guess, validate that you're on the right path. I think that's gives you a bit more confidence to push ahead and to back yourself in and to not have to change what you do. Because winemaking, I guess, is a fairly personal experience. The whole point is that you want to make wines that you need to make wines. I don't think you need to make wines that satisfy you first and then find the market that suits to a fair extent. I think you have to believe in the wines more than everyone else around you, or they're probably not going to be that good. So those moments where you get that good feedback, those absolutely, you see your wine on a fancy wine list or something, and it you know, you go, yep, okay. They're a good somm, and they think the wine's worthy of being on their list, and that absolutely is a really great feeling.
Oh yeah, it justifies all your work, and you know, again, proof of concept. Well, let's talk a little bit about the winery, about Mewstone. If you're going to describe it to people in terms of your portfolio, the wines you make, the styles, what would sort of be the summary of what you guys do?
So we built fairly quickly over those first few years. The side project was Hughes and Hughes. So you'll hear me talk about that. That is fruit that we source from other people's paddocks. My brother was on a holiday over a vintage. I said you should never take time off over March, April, because I'm going to be busy. But he did. And so I went and bought 10 ton of fruit with the blessing of buying two, but two turned into 10 accidentally. And that was the start of Hughes. So that was the idea of basically being able to have a business that was going to be big enough to be a business, because the vineyard at Mewstone at the time was 2 hectares, and it had become evident that it was going to be fairly low yielding. So 2 hectares at, you know, for us, we get maybe, as it turns out, probably even less than we hope. So we probably average 3 to 4 ton to the hectare. So off 2 hectares, we're only getting 6, 7, 8 ton. So that's not enough to make enough bottles to have a bona fide business.
Right.
Started Hughes and Hughes in the same year in 2016. So that is fruit from other people's. And in that, we get to do a really broad range. So we get to really explore what Tasmania is capable of in terms of varietal. We get to make all the varieties under the sun. And then, and also, they're probably always going to be at a price point that's a bit more accessible. So when their local wine bar here in Hobart, they're more likely to get a glass of Hughes and Hughes than they are Mewstone. One, there's a bit more of it, and it's just at a much better price point for people to be able to have a glass at lunch or at dinner. And then Mewstone is only ever, anything that goes into the Mewstone bottle is 100% from our property that we grow. And so we wanted to separate those two so that any time you pick up a bottle of Mewstone, you can know with great certainty where it's from. So I guess those wines are not about being Tasmanian. They're about being from this little patch of dirt in flower pot in southern Tasmania. They're very much pure sight-driven wines. And in that sense, we would consider them much more worthy of time in bottle, much more worthy of age, and some, I guess, the serious wines, the flagship wines. They're our Barolo, and that's the way we thought of it initially. Mewstone is our single-site Barolo. Hughes and Hughes, for me, with the Trettos, was our Blanche. That was our Arnais. That was the one that you can build a business on. Like, it's actually a profitable concept. Whereas Mewstone was, by that stage, we realized Mewstone was really just, that was the flagship.
Hey, making profit, you know, a sometimes a rare occurrence in the wine industry. By the way, I need to go back for a second. Did you say you accidentally, was it 2 tons to 10 tons? Did I hear you accidentally got it? Or?
Yeah, I was trying to find 2 ton, and then to get 2 ton, the grower suggested I needed to buy some Sauvignon Blanc to get access to his Pinot, but I had to buy it all, and I had to buy it all. And so that was 5 ton of Sauvignon, 5 ton of Sauv Blanc, and 5 ton of Pinot. My brother was in a different time zone, so I couldn't call him properly. That's what I'd say. I was just, yeah, we'll do that and deal with the consequences later. And my brother's only feedback was, well, you better sell it.
Yep. Well, that's the businessman in him. What, actually, we'll stick with Mewstone for 1 second. If you were going to describe, and that's, it's mostly Pinot and Chard and sparkling, or did I get that wrong?
Pinot Chard Riesling.
Pinot Chard and Riesling, excuse me. If you were going to describe your philosophy with these wines, or just, or really, what are you hoping to achieve with these three varietals?
So I guess across the varieties, it doesn't matter which one it is. I think what's really important to me is that sight expression, that if you pick up a bottle of It doesn't matter what vintage Riesling, Pinot, or Chard, there'll be the signature of the place in the bottle. There'll be lined lineup. I reckon that's a Muirstone. I think that for me is really important. I really want to see the line of time through the wines, but I also want them to be very vintage expressive. I think that's really important in single site wines. That 23 looks like the season. It looks like the sun that shone and the rain that fell. So Muirstone's very much about that. And within that, the Riesling we've always had, I guess I've always had a philosophy in Riesling that it's, and it probably arcs back to my time starting in New Zealand where bone dry Riesling wasn't a thing. So they always played with a lot more sugar acid balance and texture and things. I think in common sense these days of the way I hear it talked about would be the Germanic style, if you like. And that's always been Muirstone. So Muirstone's never been, it's been a bit of an outlier, particularly when I started. I guess it was more of an outlier. I feel like the industry's actually coming, we're playing in Australia now with newer styles of Riesling much more often. The old Clare and Eden Riesling are becoming, there's a whole nother market of Riesling that's opened up, which is playing with a little bit more residual sugar to balance out the acidity. So that's always been the marker of Muirstone. And then I guess in the Chard and the Pinot, they're a bit more classical. I think Riesling, you have that one big decision to make. Am I going to make it bone dry, off dry, whatever.
Right.
I think in Pinot and, or Chardonnay particularly, I've always thought of Chardonnay as a variety that you just, there is a way to make Chardonnay. We whole bunch press it. We put it in barrels. Really, the choice is how much new oak do you want? And for us, with our Pinot and Chard, the answer to that is always a reasonable amount because we have big, powerful fruit. And
Right.
so I think what the marker of Muirstone is always we have this big, powerful, intense fruit. And so we can make these big, powerful, intense wines that are going to age really, really well. And that only comes about those wines, the concept of wine, great wines are made in the vineyard. It's a bit true, but it's not completely. But it's definitely a bit true. We can't make great wines unless we have a great site because we really do need that intensity of flavour and that intensity of acidity and that intensity of all aspects of the wine to make wines that you can then do all those other things too to make sure that they do last for a long time in bottle. So Muirstone is about that. It's trying to make great wines from a great site. Very much personal wines where I've always said they're a very selfish wine because I really don't care what people think about them. Because we're only going to make 1,000 bottles of this and 2,000 bottles of that. So I only have to find a really tiny piece of the world that agrees with me and we'll be able to sell them. I think when it comes to Hughes and Hughes, we have a completely different philosophy. Those wines
Right.
have to be much more open to the market, much more responsive to what people are drinking and what they want to drink. And I think the only thing about that is you can still be trying to be ahead of the market. You can still be saying, I think there's a market, an opening here. I don't think we did that with Riesling. I don't think that people want to drink bone dry Riesling. I think there's a lot of people who want to drink more fruit-driven Rieslings. So let's make it and see if I'm right. By and large, I think being open to that concept is great. And we can play in Hughes and Hughes, we can be more playful, we can make more concept wines. If they work, they work. If they don't, we just stop doing them. So Hughes and Hughes, we have a lot more ability to try things and retreat when they don't work.
That's great. I mean, the great thing there is you get to live in all the different wine worlds, the very personal, intense, terroir, site specific. And then with Hughes and Hughes, which is more of the practical one, because you got to make the money. But even in that practical world, you still get to have the artist in you, where you get to experiment with different things, even though the Hughes and Hughes probably helps the accountant side of the world a little bit more, but you still get to try different things.
Absolutely. And I think blending in our industry is something that's increasingly maybe a wee bit overlooked. We do focus on the site wines and the single vineyard and I get it. They can be great. When they're great, they're just great. But I think the idea of the old negotiant style wine where blending is part of the art form, I think that's really important because with that we can get a certain amount of consistency where Steve from down the road, who liked our Pinot last year, we really want him to like it next year too, and the year after, and the year after. And when you're a producer who jumps around and produces this style one year and that style the next year, the consumer doesn't get dragged along with you. And I think the person who's drinking your bottle of wine, I think out of respect, we need to make sure that we we let them come along on the journey with us. And so if they liked our wines 5 years ago, they will always change. There'll always be subtle changes, not just driven by season, but by evolution. We will, you know, maybe use a little more whole bunch or a little less whole bunch, but it won't be dramatic from 1 year to the next. Within something like Hughes and Hughes, it has to be incrementally done, and we're always looking to improve it too. So notionally, there'll always be some changes in it. But Hughes and Hughes is a, yeah, it absolutely allows us to experiment, but we can do it on small scale. So if I want to see what 100% carbonic ferment looks like, I can take a ton out of the 15 ton of Pinot that we're doing and do it on that, and then I can blend it back in, and it will have an impact on the wine, but it won't be profound and completely change the wine. It would just add an aspect to the wine. So I guess a lot of the experimentation we do within Hughes and Hughes is done on a small scale to add an aspect to the wine rather than to completely change the wine. It's probably, in my head, it's always been about adding a little complexity.
Johnny, we got to wrap this up. I still so much more. Maybe we'll have to do part two when I come and visit. I am so excited to come to Tasmania. I'll be there next early March. I can't wait to visit you guys in person and just experience the Tasmanian wine scene up close. I really appreciate you taking time, and congrats on finding joy, and congrats on finding your proper job.
Beautiful. Thank you, Matthew. It's been a pleasure, and we look forward to having you down at our place.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Apple, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.